Today we're talking about appropriate discipline, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, how many times I've been in a situation where I'm like, what is the appropriate thing to do right now? Where is my super nanny when I need her? I was thinking about this one time, my kids were all under five, and we're at a playground, and there's train, it was like a big grassy area, and then train tracks. I think now they have realized, okay, playground, train tracks, they put up a fence. But my five-year-old decides, oh, look at those train tracks, and he just starts booking for those train tracks. And I'm holding the baby, and you know, I got the other little ones, you know. I'm like, Luke, stop, Luke, Luke, Luke. You know, and it just starts escalating, and it got into hysteria where I hand my baby to someone, and I'm just like screaming and running at the top of my lungs. You know, everyone's looking at you like, oh my gosh, what is she gonna do? And he's not stopping. And so it was just like a scary situation. I was scared, and then I was just also embarrassed because all the parents who were watching, what is she going to do? And he never listened to me. I finally got him, and I decided just to, the response is, we have to go home. We have to leave the park, and so we did that. But then my friend said later, is that the only discipline you gave him, just to leave the park? I mean, he didn't listen to you at all. So then I was real embarrassed, like, okay, I didn't handle that right. You know, you kind of have to get over the, okay. All right, take what she said. There's truth in there. Let's think about that. So, you know, what do you do in this situation? So we have Connie here. She's going to give us all the answers. But she's got two great credentials. She is a parent. Her kids are 21 and 26. So she's been there. She's been in that grocery store when the meltdowns happen. And, you know, she's experienced that. And she's also a grandma. Her granddaughter's five. So yeah, so she's getting to pass on that wisdom. And she's also a counselor on staff here at Xenos. So she's got a lot of wisdom to pass on to us. So let me pray, and we'll bring her up. Well, God, these parents are here because they love their kids, and they want to do a good job. And we know none of us are going to be perfect parents at all. But we really do want to be, you know, prepared and have some ideas and do, you know, just, you know, be prepared for some of those situations that come up. So I just pray that you will guide Connie, your Holy Spirit will just guide her as she's talking, that she can just give these parents some real practical things to hang on to. And, you know, when we get to the question and answer session, too, I just pray you'll give her wisdom, too, because I know people have a lot of questions in this area. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks, Kim. Hi. Thanks for coming out today. It's an honor to be at Care Group. Care Group was really kind of pivotal to me in the 1990s because God used Care Group to transform my thinking about parenting to a large degree. So I'm really glad to be here. As Kim said, I'm here not as an expert, but as a fellow parent and now a grandparent. And my credentials are because I've failed a lot. And one of the great things about the grace of God in our lives is His grace allows us to fail forward and to continue to grow and develop as a parent, even though we're imperfect and we screw up. It's okay, because we have a great God in our lives. Now, the goal of parenting is to produce a healthy adult. And we're looking for health, spiritual health, relational health, functional health, physical health. But you know, when I look in the mirror, I'm like, I'm not that healthy. So no wonder when we think about trying to produce that in our children, we get all freaked out and confused and afraid and frustrated. There's a lot of emotion that is connected to our parenting because we care so much. Now, is it possible to move from being a parent who is anxious, confused, frustrated, and fearful all the time to a parent who is hopeful, knowledgeable, courageous, and able to rest some of the time? Yes, it is. And I think parenting is such a privilege, in part. My oldest child died when he was three, and his death probably gave me a greater appreciation for parenting than if I had not lost him. So it's a great privilege, but it's also probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And that's what we're living in day to day. We all have foundational beliefs of what makes a parent effective. And those beliefs are underneath our parenting and exist even if we don't know they're there and even if we never verbalize them. For example, in the 1990s, when I first started getting to know God, I believed that what made a parent effective was that their children was always happy. Make your child happy, and you're a good parent. That was an underlying belief. And our beliefs anchor our day-to-day parenting decisions. So when I was at the grocery store with Jack, and he wanted Cocoa Puffs, and I said no, and then he started wailing, and the big crocodile tears started emerging. What did I do? I gave him Cocoa Puffs. Because my belief drove this idea that I needed to make him happy in order to be an effective parent. And those are underneath all of our day-to-day decisions, whether we know that those beliefs are there or not. It's very important for us to understand that. Dr. Ray Grundy wrote a book, Back to the Family. He's a secular pediatric psychiatrist. And he interviewed 100 excellent families, and these excellent families were identified by Teachers of the Year. And he was looking for kind of what were their foundational parenting beliefs that drove their family. And he says this: these mothers and fathers showed a real understanding of what makes family life work. What's more, so did the kids. Excellence, as defined in this book, does not mean material success or status. We searched specifically for families who embodied the highest commitment to family life and whose children collectively showed strength of character. Two things capture the essence of healthy parenthood: unconditional love coupled with the will to discipline. So these 100 excellent families had two primary beliefs that undergirded their parenting. And one was that the thing my kid needs most is unconditional love. And I can't give unconditional love if I don't have a will to discipline. Those two things are married. And that was the foundational beliefs of these 100 excellent families. The Bible also prescribes unconditional love coupled with the will to discipline as the healthy foundation from which we parent. You know, it's kind of like through our little house, this is just an illustration, through our little house, there's one thread of unconditional love. And right along with that is this thread of discipline. And those two foundational beliefs about what a kid needs most create an atmosphere for healthy parenting. What does the Bible provide us as far as instruction about parenting? Kevin Huggins, in his book, Parenting Adolescence, says this: God seems to refrain from giving formulas in Scripture. In the Bible, God has given broad boundaries for parenting and left a lot of room for the exercise of the individual parental judgment and discretion to deal with their very unique children and their very unique circumstances. So often, don't you just want someone to tell you a formula for what to do with your kids? Like, can't you just give me a formula? Well, God doesn't give us a formula. And why not? Because it wouldn't be effective. God created us as unique individuals, and he wants us to be dealt with in a very personal way. And a formula is not personal. So, this first element, before we look at discipline, we want to look at unconditional love, because you can't effectively discipline unless you have this piece in place. And this quote is from Ross Campbell. He wrote a book called How to Really Love Your Child. Excellent book. He says this: unconditional love means loving a child no matter what. No matter what the child's abilities, assets, looks, or personality traits. No matter who the child may remind you of, including yourself. no matter the history surrounding him, no matter what you expect of him, and most difficult of all, no matter what his behaviors happen to be, no matter how he acts. Of course, this doesn't mean that you always like his behavior. It means that you always love the child, even when you may detest his behavior. One of the cool things is that's how God loves us. Is he loves us unconditionally apart from our performance. Unconditional love communicates value apart from performance. I love you even when you're not behaving. It also involves accepting them and respecting them as individuals. Your children are unique individuals made in the image of God. They are not monsters. They are not creatures. And they are not a commodity that you own. They are a valuable, gifted, rebellious individual that God created uniquely. It involves investing time in them. You know, you think about a lot of discipline issues rise just because you've been ignoring your child for too long. So the time investment is, yes, coaching their soccer team, yes, playing video games with them, but it's also this one-on-one, intentional, focused time with them. And it involves knowing them. What do they like? What don't they like? What is their temperament? What are they afraid of? What do they dream about? It involves a commitment to them. And let me tell you, as the parent of now a parent, this is a lifelong commitment. But it also is a commitment that kind of changes as far as what it looks like, or it should. Otherwise, there's real problems. Okay. And it involves putting their needs before yours, not just their physical needs, but your emotional needs. I can choose to set aside my anger feelings in order to sacrifice so that I can deal with their emotions in a more effective way. I might need to do some work in order to be able to make that choice, but I, as a parent, can choose to do that. Do you love me? Kids are constantly asking this question, but not with their words. Sometimes with their words, but rarely. They're asking with their behaviors, in their fears, in their attitudes. Do you love me despite my actions, despite my weaknesses, despite my assets maybe that are different than yours, despite my attitudes? Do you love me just because I'm me? It's very important that kids get reinforced that you love them all the time, because unconditional love is the basis for security in a relationship. And when somebody has security in a relationship, then they're much better able to receive discipline and to benefit from it. Unconditional love requires more than lip service. Yes, the words need to come out of your mouth. I love you, honey. I love you, even though you're being a brat. Those need to come out of our mouth. But our attitudes and our behaviors also need to support what we're saying. And unconditional love is something we all desire. We all don't you want to know there's somebody who has your back all the time and isn't going to leave you? Yeah, we were designed to experience that. But boy, is this something really hard to live out of. And actually, it's impossible. So isn't that kind of messed up if we're supposed to be able to give our children something that's impossible for us to do? Good question. So how can we cultivate unconditional love? Well, first, we realize we all have the need for unconditional love in our lives. Kevin Huggins says, each person has a deep desire for a relationship that is unconditional and unfailing. The problem is that we live in a world where there are no perfect people who can actually give out unconditional love. So our source of unconditional love really can't be somebody else. The Bible says that this resource comes from God Himself. This is real love. It's not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his son as a sacrifice to take away our sins. And it says then, we love each other as a result of his first loving us. You know, God was the only perfect parent in the Garden of Eden. And in the Garden of Eden, he had a couple of children who said no to him. They said, no, we want to do life our way, much like our toddlers, right? And God, because he respects free will choice, allowed them to do that. And ever since, we've been born saying no to God, not just to our parents. No, I don't want you in my life. And that's really what sin is. And so because we have this kind of problem in our relationship with God, it's very difficult for us to experience his unconditional love. And that's why Jesus had to go to the cross to pay for our sins, so that that gap between us and God could be spanned. And so because of that, we can have this relationship with God as we receive that gift from Christ. This is an image, if you've heard me speak before on children, that you've seen before. But it's also, if you haven't heard me speak before, it's an image that you've seen if you've flown before. Because when you fly on an airplane, there's that safety card in the seat back pocket. And, you know, the flight attendant is telling you what to do if there's an emergency. And if there's a decompression in the cabin, you are to reach up when the oxygen mask drops down, and you're to grab a mask. And then, what are you supposed to do if you're traveling with young children? You put the mask on yourself first. Why? You're going to pass out if you don't. And then you can't give your child what you need. I like this illustration because it's, I think, very much illustrates what it looks like for us to go to God and receive his unconditional love on a daily basis, to breathe in his love. I love you no matter what. There's nothing that you can do that would make me leave you or forsake you. There's no condemnation for you because you're with me. And we need to breathe that in every day so that when we parent, the atmosphere that we're breathing out is that same unconditional love. We can do that. We can't conjure up unconditional love, but we can go to God and experience it and then let it be released from us. Okay, so unconditional love provides the atmosphere for effective discipline. Proverbs says, "For the Lord corrects those he loves, just as a father corrects a child he delights in." Did you notice that he didn't say, just as a father corrects a child he's annoyed with? No. This is an act of love. To correct a child is an act of love, and it's connected to being able to really appreciate them for who they are and who they could be. Discipline flows from love. If you refuse to discipline your child, it proves you don't love them. If you love your children, you will be prompt to discipline. The Bible is clear that love without discipline is not love. And biblical discipline without love is not real discipline. That's punishment. So I want you to consider and just sit for a few minutes and consider, how were you disciplined? What have been the effects of that discipline on you? And how do your feelings about the way you were disciplined affect your will to discipline your child? It's important for us to be aware of these questions and to think about them, because whether we know it or not, the way we were disciplined is influencing us in some ways on what we're choosing to do with our children. Maybe your discipline was too harsh and you're like, there's no way I'm ever going to be harsh with my kids. That could be a good thing. Unfortunately, that doesn't often translate then correctly, right? But you may also go too far the other way and not give your child what they really need out of kind of the feelings that you had growing up. So it's important for us to be aware of these things. In part because there's a lot of blind sides that can hit us that interrupts our will to discipline. In this book, The Manipulative Child, I think a must read for every parent, Cotter and Swihart point out some blind sides that often interrupt our discipline. The first one is fear of losing the child's love, or I would say, what if my kid doesn't like me? That interrupts a lot of discipline. Inconvenient times and places. Kim just talked about one where she didn't let people being embarrassed prevent her from making her kids leave the park. It's good. She wasn't blindsided by that time. Your feelings triggered by your child's emotion. My example of Jack at the store, not only was it that, you know, my responsibility was to make him happy, but those crocodile tears. Oh. How about fear of angrily losing control? We may be wise to fear this, and if that's the case, we might need to do some anger work. We do a lot of that in counseling with parents, learning how to be more effective in dealing with their anger issues. But also, as we learn to be more proactive in discipline, we can prevent ourselves from getting to this point of being so mad where we lose control. A little irritated is a lot different than raging. We may lack confidence. We all lack confidence, I think. That's why we're here. We may have parental overload. We're working a lot. We're involved in community a lot. You know, we like to decorate our house, or we like to run, or we like to do these other things, and our kids are in activities, and parental overload. I just have to get you out the door so I won't make you follow through. They have some ideas for how you can work on these blind sides. On this particular one, they talk about the self-discipline of learning to prioritize the very important things that don't interrupt discipline. How about guilt over a child's stress? We're going to talk about this more later. Conflict between parents. Oh, my husband and I had to work long and hard to get on the same page about what discipline should look like. And then parental beliefs often. The ones, especially that you're not aware of, come in and interrupt your discipline. We all have some of these blind sides. We just need to be honest about them. We need to allow to get input on these blind sides, ask for help, pray about them, so that we can be more and more effective with our kids. So, what is discipline? I like this definition from Ross Campbell. Discipline is to train the child in mind and character to enable him or her to become a self-controlled, constructive member of society. So much of what we do in parenting happens today, but it's for the future. And so it's future-focused. Character development is a process. I'm here as a 55-year-old lady telling you I'm still in the process. My character has a long way to go. And so we kind of have to get that in our mind so that we will parent for the long haul and we don't give up. Because just because our kid's character at 7 isn't, you know, more mature than us, we don't have to give up. Why is discipline needed? This is Boundaries with Kids. Anybody read this book? This is an excellent book. Excellent book. They say this. An accurate description of children is that they are little people who are out of control of themselves and attempting to control everyone around them. Isn't that true? They do not want to take control of themselves and adapt to the requirements of mom and dad. They want mom and dad to change the requirements. That's what we're living and breathing every day, you know? And they're so firm about it because they really, really, really are trying to do that. The problem is they don't have the maturity to really be in control. And that can be very dangerous. What discipline isn't? Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger by the way you treat them. That word also can be, that provoke can mean to exasperate. Rather, bring them up with discipline and instruction that comes from the Lord. What's the difference between punishment and discipline? Well, punishment inflicts penalty to stop negative behavior. You speed and a policeman catches you, you get a ticket. That's to try to keep you from doing that again. Discipline, on the other hand, corrects and promotes positive behavior. So a lot of discipline, you may stop a negative behavior, but really your goal is to train towards something positive. It's very future-focused. Punishment focuses on past misdeeds, and discipline focuses on future behavior. So it's you know, saying stop and turn and move in a different direction. Punishment tends to produce feelings of fear, guilt, and hostility. Even if you deserve a speeding ticket, doesn't it make you mad? Right? But discipline tends to produce feelings of security and hope. You know, you think about, like, if you're training for a marathon and you run and one day and then two and then three and then 30 days. Doesn't that training experience give you confidence that you can get to the finish line? That's how discipline is for our kids. Okay. Components of biblical discipline. Well, the foundational component of biblical discipline is this unconditional love. Everything gets built on top of it. The first year of life is primarily about bonding and nurturing with your child. There is some of the get up off your butt and go and pick up the child and redirect them, but so much of the first year is about this unconditional love, and then we keep building on top of that, and we keep giving unconditional love. The first kind of component is instruction, and instruction is communicating with words. It's also modeling what you want behavior to look like. And you add to instruction, sorry about that, you add to instruction training. You instruct, and then you give the child opportunity to practice. And as they're practicing, as you're seeing them practice, they will fail. And then you correct, and then unconditional love, instruct, train, correct. And this just becomes kind of a rotating process. This is out of Boundaries with Kids. It's a good example of this process. If your boundary training exists only of words, you are wasting your breath. But if you do boundaries with your kids, and boundaries is just a form of discipline, if you do boundaries with your kids, they internalize the experiences, remember them, digest them, and make them a part of how they see reality. On teaching Ricky 7 and Benny 5 about money, they say this: when the process started, the boys thought money grew on trees. They liked having it, but had no sense of fiscal responsibility. We instructed them several times on saving up for what they wanted and not spending it all at once. It went in one ear and out the other. It was not their fault. They simply had no experience with wanting something and being broke. Wow. One day, the boys used all their spending money on a toy they wanted. A couple of days later, a comic book they had wanted for a long time went on sale, and they wanted their spending pouches. The pouches were empty. So they went to mom and dad for help. We said, no gifts, no loans. Earn it at the usual weekly rate. They asked if they could do extra chores. We said no. That's probably where I would have given in and said yes. Then they cried. We empathized with them with the loss of the sale on sale opportunity, but the pouches stayed empty. A few hours later, Benny said, I'm going to wait a long, long time next time. And he did, and they did. No amount of lecturing or nagging would have accomplished this result. It took an experience with parental boundaries to develop child boundaries. You are like an oak tree that the child runs her head into over and over again until she realizes the tree is stronger than she is and she walks around. I'm not like an oak tree.
If the parents would have just went ahead and gave in to the kid wanting to do extra chores, is he saying that's good not to do that because then you're setting that boundary and helping them to learn that experience?
Yes, okay. Yes, yeah, absolutely.
That's what I wanted to clarify.
Yes, that's okay. True. That's what they're saying. And actually, we're going to go through this and think about what just happened with our little paradigm. First of all, these parents, and you didn't get to read this part, they were motivated by unconditional love for these boys, that they could learn how to handle money effectively. Because not handling money effectively really can screw up your life, as some of us probably know. And so they were thinking of the future with these boys when they came up with this plan. And so they came up with a plan, and they instructed the boys. They said, do your chores, earn your money. With your money, you're going to save some, you're going to give some, and you're going to get to spend some. And that's what their spending pouches were for. So they instructed them. And then they let these boys start practicing with their spending pouches. And they weren't surprised when the boys didn't learn the lesson that they used with their mouth. They weren't surprised. They expected it. Because a part of training is failing. And so they weren't frustrated by it. They anticipated that this would need to be something that was learned through failure. They also, when the boys' pouches were empty and they didn't give in to the boundary, they weren't like, told you so. You should have listened to my words. I've been telling you over and over again. No, they did not do that. What they did was, oh, I'm really sad for you. That is so hard. I remembered one time I really wanted to buy something that was on sale and I didn't have the money because I had spent it on something else. And I was so disappointed. I know you're so disappointed, but they kept the boundary. There's a very big difference in empathy and boundary versus I told you so and boundary. Okay, and then I think, you know, they were able to give their boys a skill that's going to serve them and make them a healthy, constructive adult. Discipline is essential. Proverbs says, discipline your children while there is still hope. Otherwise, you will ruin their lives. That's kind of scary, isn't it? But you think about, even from this money examples, how many of us didn't have parents who taught us with discipline how to handle money and then had to face learning that as an adult the hard way, where the stakes wasn't a comic book, but something very different. That future focus with discipline gets us through these day-to-day battles. What does discipline produce? I like this. This is one of the excellent parents from Grundy's book. I want my kids to always stand up and face the wind. I think that is a reflection of the strength that it is often required of people to maintain themselves in society today. I hope we've taught the kids to stand up and face things as they come, always being accountable for their own actions. So we want to produce the type of child who can really be able to face the hard things of life, because hard things in life happen. We can't protect our kids from that. We need to teach them how to face those things, and discipline is a big part of that. Hebrews says, no discipline is enjoyable while it is happening. It's painful. But afterwards, there will be peace, a peaceful harvest of right living for those who are trained in this way. We love our kids. We hate to see them in pain. But for us to think that we can discipline our child without them experiencing pain is unrealistic. So if our goal is not to have our kids experience pain, then we're probably not going to discipline. And again, you think about the marathon example, it would be ludicrous for you to think, I can go out and run the half marathon today that's going on. Because I don't run. It's too painful, I walk. But to think that you should be able to go out and do that kind of rigorous exercise without the pain of training, you would think I was nuts. So we must brace ourselves to allow our children to experience pain, not unnecessary pain, but the pain of discipline so that they can become the person that God intended them to be. The goal of discipline is self-regulation. We want our children to, and let me just say something about self-regulation. Our goal is self-regulation, and so what we want is to train our children so that the things that we do for them, they increasingly can do for themselves. How many of you know adults whose parents still take care of things in their life that they should be able to take care of? It's harder to learn it when you're 20 or 30 or 40 years old. So this training begins now. So increasingly, we want them to be able to critically assess the influences around them. You know, we've got to do a lot of instructing and training. But increasingly, and by the time your child is a teenager in particular, they need to be able to say, I see that option, and I see that option, and this would hurt me, and this one would not, and so I'm going to choose this path. You also want them to be able to critically assess their own feelings. I feel like I'm never going to recover again because my girlfriend broke up with me. But I know I can choose to get up and go back and reconnect with friends and keep moving on in life. Our kids need to be able to learn to assess their feelings and make choices that are different than what their feelings are telling them. We also want them to learn to take responsibility for their actions and attitudes. And this training happens at a pretty young age, should start developing at a pretty young age. Well, according to the Boundaries Guy, Cloud and Townsend, a 3 to 5 year old can understand basic cause and effect. And so, certainly, you know. My granddaughter's 4, she'll be 5 next month, but she's been playing this game because something will happen and she'll say, a ghost did that. Well, she did that. She did that, you know, and so I'll play the game with her, but then we'll get back in touch with reality of, oh, have that boo-boo on your knee because you didn't listen to me when I said to sit down in the stroller and you fell out. So take responsibility. The reason I have a boo-boo on my knee is because I didn't sit down and I fell out of the stroller. We also want them to get to the point that they can problem solve. And one of the ways they learn to problem solve is for you to stop solving all their problems. And so, you know, there's brother and sister going at it, mommy, mommy, and mom, you know, mediates. Well, there has to be a point where you turn that over to them and you say, you know what to do to mediate a conflict, and do it. That they can respect authority even when they don't agree with authority. Because isn't that a grown-up skill that we need? Right? That they can set goals and work toward them. There are some personality types that do this almost naturally. And then there are some who don't do this. My son fell in the category, he's a brilliant guy, but we used to call him the absent-minded professor. A brilliant person who couldn't plan his way out of a paper bag. So we had to really help him learn how to develop skills that didn't come naturally to him. And he can at least do that at work, and you know, so that there's progress. But it doesn't come intuitively to him, and it takes energy, and he has to work hard at it. But we helped him develop those skills. They need to understand cause and effect. Again, this this quote, they said a 3 to 5 year old can learn that obeying you brings good things. And ignoring you brings discomfort. And that is motivation for them to then do the good thing. Deny instant gratification. This is a really needed one in our culture. Everything is instant. We could probably benefit from some of this ourselves, right? So we want to help our kids learn how to do this. And we can talk afterwards if you have questions on how to maybe develop some of these skills. Okay, and to be givers. We want to help our children learn to be givers. And, you know, that they gave an example of givers of money, but of also their talent, their time, their friendships. And increasingly, we want to see that they're developing that heart to be other-focused. And that it's not just because we're telling them to do it. Okay, I want to talk and finish up our formal part here for a little bit on this kind of complications of uniqueness. Discipline is hard, but then there's unique situations or things about our kids that make it even more complicated. The first one is experiences. Some of us are parenting children with experiences that are very difficult. Perhaps your child is a child of a divorce. Perhaps your child is suffering the loss of a parent or a close friend or a grandparent. Perhaps your child has learning differences. Perhaps your child is being bullied. Maybe your child is adopted. Well, all of these hard experiences affect our discipline. And we need to be sensitive to their experiences and adapt our discipline to that without using it as an excuse not to discipline. God doesn't say discipline only the children who are in good circumstances and everything's going well in their life. That's not what that says. It's if you love your child, no matter what circumstance you're in, you will discipline your child. Also, here's an area of talents and gifts. Our kids are unique, and different kids have different talents and different gifts. You may have a child that's musically talented, and their sibling may not be musically talented. Now, if you just use everybody does the same thing in our family rule, and practice for the musically talented child and the unmusically talented child is supposed to look the same, you're going to provoke your child. And you're going to die on a hill that probably doesn't matter. You know, God wants us to help our children develop into the best version of them that He wanted them to be, which means not comparing them to each other as siblings, and not comparing them to little Johnny, whose parents are in home church with you. Comparing doesn't help us in parenting. Comparing doesn't help us to live a life of freedom and abundance. How about physical and emotional health issues? This is hard. This is really hard. But I want to give you a real-life example out of my life. My sister was born deaf. And my mom got German measles when she was pregnant with her, which is why she's deaf. And my mom felt very, very guilty about my sister being born deaf. And she was the youngest. And so she did absolutely everything for my sister. And instead of disciplining her in the same way that she disciplined, and discipline was hard for her anyway, but in the same way she had disciplined even my sister and I, she just did everything for her entire life until my mom died when she was 21. So my sister is 50. She cannot keep a job. She has few friendships. And she really is pretty functionally inept about basic things like checkbook and keeping your house and things like that. Now, her husband also is deaf. He completely lost his hearing by the time he was 2, which was the same year his mom died in a plane crash. Now, his dad understood the principles of unconditional love and discipline, and so he taught Steve how to take responsibility for his life. He taught Steve that he could set goals and work towards them. He taught Steve to respect authority. And so Steve, you know, wanted to play the trumpet in the marching band as a deaf kid. He set goals, he followed the process to those goals, and he marched in the marching band playing the trumpet wonderfully all through high school. He wanted to work with computers. He set goals and went to college, and he's, you know, got a good career in computer science. He has good friends, and he has loved my sister and stayed in a marriage with her for 25 years, even though she's very difficult. Now, I love my sister, and I've seen her since my parents have died actually grow, because Steve disciplines her, and my other sister and I and some other people in her life discipline her. In fact, she ran a half marathon last week because she's starting to learn that she can be trained to do something hard. So it's not too late, but you can see that my mom did her no favors by feeling sorry for her and then refusing to discipline. All right, and then another unique complication of uniqueness is what I'm calling hardwiring. Other words for hardwiring might be personality type or temperament, okay? And we're unique individuals. We're all unique. God says we're uniquely made. And we all come into life with different personality strengths and weaknesses. Now, we want to be very careful that we don't pigeonhole our kid into a particular personality and, yeah, he's never going to be any different than this or anything like that. But we're wise to understand some of the components of hardwiring because it can help us to be more effective with our discipline. I'm primarily right-handed. This is my dominant hand. But I can use my left hand. In fact, both these hands can work together to pick up a box that I wouldn't be able to do with just my dominant hand. And so with hardwiring and personality, we usually have a dominant tendency, and then we have secondary tendencies as well. I like to use characters when I talk about hardwiring, especially with kids, because I think it just makes it more real. And so we're going to use Pooh characters today. And here's just kind of an illustration of how we're kind of a combination of different personality types. So you might have a dominant Tigger kid with a Piglet as a secondary, or a dominant Rabbit with a Tigger as a secondary. Now, some of you are hardwired in such a way that you're looking at this kind of, you know, cheesy little mock-up and you're thinking, boy, if that was Photoshop, you could really make that look a lot better. And, oh, you could put all the different combinations in there. But I'm not that personality type, and so I'm an efficiency expert. So as Liv was doing art, my granddaughter, I was like, oh, I can just do this and take a picture of it and upload it, and it'll make my point, is that we're a combination often. But it's important for us to recognize that this hardwiring exists so that we can adapt our approaches with our different children, and we're going to illustrate that. Your kids say, you didn't have her sit in time out for that. That's not fair, right? You get some of that? As a parent, we want to be effective more than we want to be fair, which means sometimes different disciplines for different kids for the same infraction, because we're trying to be effective. All right, so let's think about training Tigger. Tigger is bouncy, bouncy, bouncy. Did you see that? You know, they're just off. And they're so endearing. They make friends quickly. They love to have fun. There's so many great qualities of a Tigger. But a Tigger talks too much. And Tigger wants all the attention. So as we're effectively trying to help Tigger become a constructive adult, we're going to want Tigger to learn that he doesn't have to talk as much as he thinks he does. And we're going to want Tigger to learn that it's not healthy for him to have all the attention all the time. And so my granddaughter has a little bit of Tigger in her. And we were noticing, we have her over on Friday nights for an overnight, that at dinner, when John, my husband, and I would try to interact, she would interrupt and just, you know, there was no way we were allowed to talk to each other. And so we tried, Liv, stop the interruption. Pop and I have something important to say. I want to hear what you have to say, but you'll have to wait. And it really wasn't being very effective for her because she just kept interrupting and she'd be in timeout. And then, well, you know, dinner wasn't what it was supposed to be, which is a time to get together and enjoy a meal and talk about life. So John was thinking about this, and he came up with this idea. So one day, she came over, and before dinner, he's like, Liv, I've got a new game for us to play. And of course, she was like, what is it, Pop? And he's like, you have to wait till dinner. And so at dinner, she sat down and he gave the rules. He's like, here's the game. It's so exciting. One person gets to ask another person a question, and then they answer. And after they answer, they get to ask another person the question. So we started playing this game. So she wanted to go first. And she said, Pop, where did you work today? And so John answered. And then John asked her, what did you do today? And she said, we went to the zoo. And he's like, what was your favorite part of the zoo? And so he was showing her how to ask a follow-up question. And then she got to ask me a question, and dinner was pleasant as we played this game together. The next week, though, what really surprised us is at dinner time, she's like, I can't wait to play the game. She's learning that she doesn't have to talk all the time, and she's learning how pleasant it is to really be able to engage somebody else and find out about them. That's an example of training Tigger. Timeout is a good tool for Tiggers because Tiggers hate two things. They hate not to be with people, and they hate to sit still. So you want to make discomfort painful. I started timeout at 2, and my kind of parameter is a chair where there's nothing else around where I can have an eye or an ear to resit as necessary. And I use a minute for every age with a timer.
And you said you started at 2.
Mm-hmm. And 2, you know, you first start, you're not going to do 2 minutes at 2 when you begin. But by the time they're getting ready to turn 3, they should be able to sit for 2 minutes and have that level of self-control, is my opinion. I'm not an expert. That's my experience. Okay, Eeyore. Are you training an Eeyore? Eeyores are creative. They're sensitive, they care deeply about other people, but but they're also critical and negative and perfectionist. And if you're an Eeyore sitting here, you're probably mad that we're talking about temperaments. All right. But do your child a favor and do their future spouse a favor and start working on this negativity and perfectionism now. So here's an idea. Play the glad game. Use their creativity and have them come up with a container. They love to create things. And they can make a jar, a box. They can make a Lego container. You just get them busy making a container. And you let them exercise that for their glad game. And then you start playing the game. And on a daily basis, they have to think of something that they're glad about. And then they take a marble and they put it in that container, or if they're old enough to write it out, they can take a slip of paper and put it in the container. And then when the container is full, you take them on a special outing or you have special time with them as a reward. Reward is not effective for stopping a negative behavior, but it's very effective for building a behavior that you want. And sometimes reward is catching them doing it right. That's, I really liked it when I saw that you chose to, even though you were disappointed, find the good thing. And that's true for all the temperaments. Also, for the perfectionist, give them a deadline, insist that they keep it. We raised an Eeyore who would work on a project for school and not want to turn it in because it wasn't as well done as he wanted it to be. And then he'd get a million on it. My husband is an Eeyore by dominant, and he says that a lot of his life, he spent 90% of his time improving something, 5%. That's a stewardship issue. Because God wants us to go out and love other people with our 90% of time versus getting something to a level that really it doesn't, it's fine at without being at that level. So I think we started just training a deadline. Here's how long you can work on it, and then you're out playing with friends. Now, other kids, you have to, Tigger, you need to do it differently, right? But with Eeyore, you can learn to help them see that they don't have to have something perfect in order for it to be adequate. All right. Rabbit. Oh, I'm a rabbit, as you can tell. Rabbits. I can get a lot done in a day. Rabbits are very productive, very functional, strategic. I don't mind making a decision, but I'm bossy and headstrong, and I can be very proud and arrogant. And, you know, who wants to be around rabbit? You think about it. You see the little Pooh characters at the store. They never sell rabbit. Who wants to be around rabbit? And unfortunately, I didn't know that for a long time. I just thought everyone was like me. Sorry about this. What can I do? I don't know. Okay. So, obviously, we need to help Rabbit to learn to take turns and not to just be controlling everything. And so, with rabbits, it's great if you can make it a challenge. And a challenge could be, hey, and it could be a similar thing with the container with a marble, but they don't want to make the container unless they can get it done like that. But, you know, make it a challenge. For every time that you choose to let your friend choose the game and then you actually play it with a good attitude, you can put a marble in the jar. And once you get a marble in the jar, then, you know, we can have some sort of reward. But it has to be a challenge. I don't think you can do this. Also with Rabbit, you need to pick your battles and win. Okay, I'm the rabbit, and I used to do this to my mom up against the tree. And my mom would often cave. At five, I had the same memory of thinking I was smarter than both my parents. And probably by the time I was eight, I was running the house. That did not serve my relationships well in life. And thankfully, God gave me a husband who learned to stand up and discipline me. And Bev Delashman, my wife, said, stop, honey, that's not okay. And I respect those people. A rabbit will learn to respect somebody who will stand their ground. And when a rabbit respects you, then you have a voice in their life. So pick your battles and pick them so that you can win. Piglet. Are you training a piglet? Piglets are easygoing, happy-go-lucky. They're often known as the naturally good kid. So Piglet, Piglet hates to make a decision. Is there a problem with that? There's a big problem with that. Because that means Piglet is going to follow everybody else's choices. And if Piglet gets connected with some people who are making pretty bad choices, guess what Piglet does? Follow along. So we really need Piglet to learn to make decisions. And here's a suggestion. Require a choice. Require them to choose. Don't just give in to them. Well, I don't care. You choose. Require them to choose. If you do a family night or a family day, a good way to do this is to have each week a different member of the family picks the activity. And your little piglet, when it comes to their turn, they're not going to want to pick. Help them come up, talk through, but require them to pick. Even if you give them two choices, require them to pick. And then once they choose, after you've done the activity, that was so awesome. You made such a great choice. Look, you can make really good choices. We need to help Piglet to have the confidence that they can make a good choice. So we want to be building that. Self-righteous Piglet thinks he's morally better than his siblings. Truth is, he just doesn't have the energy to be overtly sinning. He's not morally better than your Tigger or your rabbit. He's just easier. So our piglet, we had something that we called the catching sin, catching her brother doing wrong so she could feel better about herself. And that's what she got a consequence for. Every time she tattled on him, she was given a work assignment. You see, time out isn't good for Piglet, because Piglet just likes to sit by themselves alone doing nothing. That doesn't cause any discomfort. For Piglet, you want their consequence to be activity of some sort. And also, I don't think timeout is that good for Eeyore either, because Eeyore just sits and ruminates, and then he goes down the black hole. So I think consequences for Eeyore being more active is better as well. So those are just some examples of how it looks like to understand maybe some hardwiring of your child and to adapt kind of your training process to their hardwiring. All right, so that's what I have, and now I just want to open the floor for questions, comments.
Sorry about that. Two questions, I guess, really. One is, when you have multiple kids, siblings, and usually they're all some variation of personality, so we have three. So the challenge is navigating how to deal and do things personally with each one when they're all there at the same time, pushing and pulling in their own way for your attention and your focus. So that's the one first challenge is, how do you counterbalance or balance amongst the competing interests that they each one have, and two, understanding your own natural hardwiring in terms of how it connects. Because I know in my case, one of my kids, I have a natural, I have a gravitational pull a little bit more, because I feel like I understand them a lot more than I understand perhaps a couple of the others, and so it's a much more natural fit, and so it's a much different and challenge for me to work with the other ones because I don't get it very well.
Great question. And I don't know that I can really answer it fully, because part of this is that parenting is a dance. And so we're just, you know, trying to take a step and see which steps work and which ones don't. Knowing your own hardwiring, I think, is really key. And it could be that when, like you said, you're connecting to one kid more naturally than the other because you kind of understand how they tick and how they work. Becoming a student of the different aspects of temperament, though, can help you to be more effective with the ones that are different than you. So, for example, my son is an Eeyore, and I have, of all the, kind of when I do some of the assessments, I have like this much Eeyore in me. And so, for me, there were things where I just was not that effective with him. And later in life, I asked him once when I was doing a parenting thing, because I thought Dad was a little harsh with him. I'm like, so who was more effective? And he's like, well, Dad by far. And sometimes I think that's what we just have to accept, is that, you know, as if we're fortunate enough, and not all of us are, to be parenting with somebody that we're working together to be as effective as possible, we can realize that, you know, one of our hardwiring is going to be more effective in some situations, and then the other parent's going to be more effective in others. So there's that complexity. And then with kids together, you know, I think part of what I would be thinking of in if I had your three, and, you know, one of the things I considered is, how do I get them more and more taking on the responsibility for their relationship with each other instead of me always being in the middle of it? And I'm not, you know, that's very difficult in the toddler years, right? And a lot of what you're doing is, you know, redirecting and, you know, trying to help them learn to have some healthy relational skills amongst each other. But as they get older, I think some of this is stepping out, some of their out of controlling their environment and letting them figure things out between each other. I also think that there's a boundary that we can set when we're having family time where you can say, this is about us together, it's not about this. And so we need to figure out how to do this together. And in part, the thing with my granddaughter, one of that situation would be a situation where we're making it an all-one thing. She was very used to having one-on-one time with me or one-on-one time with John. But when it came together, then she was demanding, oh, it needs to look like that. Well, it's not going to look like that. Group things don't look like that. And so begin learning to teach them, we're trying to do this as a group, and that means us serving each other by sharing time for talk and other things.
I have a question. Earlier, you were talking about discipline versus the punishment. And I have a son. He's going to be 5 this month, and he's in school. And this week was horrible. Bad reports every day, bad colors. So without being able to be there to stop and redirect and try to find a positive outcome, how should I discipline him, so to speak, on something that's already been in the past? I'm not really sure how to go about it, because I want to address, like, what he did, if it was pull a girl's hair or rip wallpaper off a wall or something like that. Those are two examples from this mm-hmm. week. But, like, I don't know how to say, like, this is not acceptable behavior without, like, ruminating on it.
Okay. Here's an example from my day yesterday with my granddaughter that's similar. She had two time out at school for different things. And so one of the things that we've been building is just her being honest about what's really going on when she's not around. And so around, you know, her family unit. And so I've been asking her, how did school go yesterday? And originally she said, well, it was great. And then I'm like, no, is that true? And she's like, well, actually I got two timeouts. And so then we sat and we talked about what the timeouts were for, and believe it or not, they were about pulling hair, and then the other was about not pouting after she didn't get her way on what game to play. And so what I did with her, because she already had her consequence at school, what I did with her is, Liv, let's think about how you can make a different choice next time. And so, and then keep it forward thinking and start in that instructing mode. So I asked her, so why did you pull Becky's hair? What was going on? Well, she had a toy I wanted. Okay, so let's think about how you could deal with that in a different way.
So I have a question. What would you do for, timeouts are ideal for certain ages, right? So, but if you have different temperaments, a tiger would like timeouts, but another child would not like timeouts because they are not a sanguine. But sometimes the timeouts do work. And they will say, a child would say, I would say, why are you in timeout? Because I hit somebody. Mm-hmm. So it just depends on how they react to your discipline, right? And then the other thing is, I do have a 10-month-old, and I've heard that you can start telling them no at this age, and you can start in not disciplining them in a negative way. But for example, yesterday I was at my mom's house and she was almost going to the electric thing, right. And I said no touch, mm-hmm. And I was like, this is hard, yeah. It's not your emotions, it's hard for us to control our emotions.
Absolutely.
Or if you're disciplining the kid all day long, then that's really like, then I feel like I'm a bad caregiver or I'm a bad parent, because all what I'm doing is the same thing over and over and over. But I think it depends on their ages.
Age has a lot to do with it. And also, I like your point, that it's not just Tigger who can benefit from timeout. And I like what you said, is we try disciplined things, and we practice them, and we see if they're effective or not. And if they're effective, we use them, and if they're not, we can move on to something else. But the other thing with this is that I think with under one or even under two, no is appropriate. But this is the get up off your butt time of parenting. We have to be willing to get up, pick up, redirect, and to do that over and over again. And it's exhausting. It is so exhausting. And that is the reality of this time of life. I think about it and I tell parents this all the time. When you are the parent of a toddler, some days are so long you think that you can't survive them. But then you look back and you're like, oh my God, where'd the time go?
I work in a classroom of 14 2-year-olds. So I understand somewhat of the, and I'm pregnant. So I have all of this to look forward to and the learning. But I have a question of, my husband and I have been looking for some sort of book to read together on a date night. And you've suggested a few books that are obviously awesome. Are we jumping the gun if we're reading this early?
No.
I see behaviors at work.
Read
that
now because
like,
you won't have time to later.
That's true.
So I think a great book for beginning is How to Really Love Your Child by Ross Campbell. It's great. And also Tripp's book, Shepherding a Child's Heart, is good, because those are more, they do get into some specifics about things, but it's also building kind of the foundational, this is what healthy parenting can look like.
Awesome, thank you.
Yeah. How to Really Love Your Child by Ross Campbell and Paul David Tripp, Shepherding a Child's Heart.
I'm sorry to make you do this, but can you actually just pull up the slide that has the punishment versus discipline?
Yeah.
We're also going to put this on the Xenos website, her PowerPoints and her talk, so you can refer.
kids. We're getting there. Sorry.
What other ways can we help our toddler before they have this comprehension, like starting later, like you said, 2 or 3?
How else can we prepare them for
all that good stuff you were talking about with the discipline and self-regulation, all those things they learn? How do we prepare them for that, and how do we, is there a practical way that we can?
Some practical things. I like toy timeout a lot.
Yeah.
Where instead of you sit them in timeout, you remove a toy that they like, and you put it in the closet for a long period of time, enough that it's uncomfortable for them. That's something that's really practical. I think that depending on the age, beginning to teach them some responsibility by them having tasks to do at home can be an effective training tool. I'm going to do this punishment one first. Okay, so, you just wanted to see it. Okay.
So I know you said, too, is a time when you can start with timeouts and such. And, I've got 2 girls. They're getting a little bit older, but I babysit young ones. I do home child care.
Yep.
And I just followed their mom's footsteps for these 2 children. And starting around, I think, 15, 16 months even, I would do what she would do, which is if they bit one another, hurt one another, took a toy, have them sit with ready hands, which is just hands together.
Uh-huh.
Just sit where they are, ready hands. And the ready hands is just so they're not touching everything.
Yeah,
and I had
right.
to hold their hands together, at the beginning. But and then the other thing is with the older one who's just very strong-willed, they were both foster kids, and they're just like a few months apart. Yeah. So with the one that's like 4 months older, he has a very strong temperament about him. Strong-willed, and just like the mom would do, if he would start throwing a big fit, remove him, put him in the pack and play, which he hated, and when he was done throwing his fit and was ready to come out and not throw a fit, then he could come out of the pack and play. But just these simple things I have found have done so much good, and now they will sit with ready hands, the one especially, before I even tell him that much. If he knows he's done something wrong, just sits with ready hands, and then and I guess the other thing I should mention is she does sign language, a lot of sign language. So, and I'll use that too, and so we'll have them say sorry. And I know they don't totally understand the meaning of sorry, but I think they really are starting to get
to
it
absorb
now that they're
it.
2 and almost 2. It seems like it's starting to sink in. So I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, but I've found that to be really effective with these boys.
Yeah,
it's just to teach them, this isn't something you can do around us.
And,
you know?
Right, and sometimes, I like those suggestions, Jenny, and sometimes, like, I had my piglet who, piglets are pretty flexible, but when they're stubborn, they're stubborn. And she also has a rabbit side, so she would not necessarily, she would be upset, but would refuse comfort. And so we would put her in her room, in her bed, and we would say, when you're ready for a hug, we want to give you one, you can come out and receive it. And over time, she learned that, she was one who would push away comfort, but then she learned over time that she really wanted it and would come and receive hugs and allow us to help her calm down.
Yeah. Thanks for this presentation. It was really, really good and very helpful. So I never really thought about it this way. I think we might have a piglet who's 3, and she can be very stubborn. She's kind of a real easygoing, happy child, but we're really struggling with her following direction. Mm-hmm. And so I struggle with, how many times do I say, come brush your teeth? It's just usually little things, and she's just not listening.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do then I approach her so that I'm not, saying, come brush your teeth, come brush your teeth, come brush your teeth 10 times.
Mm-hmm.
Where do I draw that line? And then how do I, get her to understand I need you to listen? And then what is an appropriate punishment for, not punishment, discipline for a small thing? You didn't listen to me the first time, so.
Okay, so actually not listening is not a small thing.
And what we end up doing, thinking, oh, it's a small thing, we reinforce, oh, I don't need to listen to mom until she's told me 10 times. And so, you know, I by temperament am not, in some ways, not a super consistent person, but consistency, even in a small thing, can pay off big dividends. And so if it's bedtime that you're trying to get her to brush her teeth, for example, you might instruct, okay, I know we've been having problems with brushing our teeth when I say, but we're going to have a new thing we're going to do. And so tonight, if you don't brush your teeth when I say the first time, we're not going to be able to read a story. So I think getting on top of that, because we really, and I did this so much, you know, I'm a much better grandparent than parent when it comes to this, is that we don't want to reinforce, you don't need to listen to me the first time. Manipulative child has a great little just three-step process for this. So you might want to pick up that book. No, yeah. That's where they're, you know, we get blindsided with each new kid.
Yeah, you talked about empathy versus I told you so, but then also getting them to learn cause and effect. Yes. So how do you balance, okay, they did something wrong or maybe they hurt themselves, showing empathy, but also at some point, do you do empathy first and then wait to explain it later?
I think it's probably more effective to do empathy first as they're crying. Oh, I can see that really hurts. And then how did that happen would be a conversation that once they're calmed down, and then you can say, I'm sorry that happened, but next time, this is how you can keep from getting hurt, where you're keeping it in the future instead of dwelling on the past.
So I might stumble through this just a little bit, but I don't remember exactly where I heard it, but about timeouts. So we have a Tigger child, and she mirrors me. You know what I mean? So that's cool. For me, not for my wife, you know, and very sanguine. So, but basically, as far as timeouts are concerned, what we've done, and at least what we have found works for her, and she exhausts a lot of people, but so when we put her in timeout, we physically have to, my wife tells me, take her to timeout. Don't say, just go to timeout. You physically put her in timeout. We say 3 minutes and then 10 seconds of silence. So even if she's throwing a temper tantrum for 10 minutes, she actually, as soon as she like calms down and succumbs to the fact that she is under discipline, you know what I mean? It's like, and then you can go and talk to her and take her out of timeout. It's not just the egg timer goes off and you can get down even though you threw a temper tantrum and be in control of it. So that's actually where, with me, her personality turned around and she actually started listening and responding rather than trying to be so in control. So
that's awesome.
Thank you
for
everything.
Yeah, and I like that 10-minute thing. And I think that anytime we're giving a consequence, we need to help. We need to be able to reiterate, I love you. This is what happened, and this is what we want in the future. Yeah, good.
Unfortunately, this has to be the last one. Okay. We're going to have to cut it off. Okay, thank you. One. It's been wonderful. It's
right here. Okay.
Spanking. What are your thoughts and everything on that?
Well, biblically speaking, there is the Bible, I think, is not anti-spanking, but it is anti-beating. And so we need to be very, very careful about spanking, I think. I think you need to consider what your own conscience tells you. But one thing I think we need to take completely off the table is any kind of spanking in anger. If you're angry and your child needs a spank, you need to go calm yourself down, until it can be done in a way that is respectful and in control. Now, we were actually, my friends and I were talking about this the other day. My daughter, the piglet, probably got spanked 2 times. I spanked for danger. And, you know, my Tigger, my Eeyore, my husband was like, we've got to find a consequence where he's not sitting and ruminating and going down the hole. And a spank can be a way for him to have it over with and be able to move forward quickly. And he didn't get spanked a lot, but he had more spanks than my piglet. And it was always within a controlled environment. But I do think you have to have it up to your conscience.
Isn't there an age group, too, that's appropriate?
Yeah, when they're when they're much younger. And, you know, I don't think our kids had a spank after 6, 5 or 6.